Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening. You guys are like my best friends, and I feel like you're in for a treat on this episode. I was fascinated by interviewing author Nathan Morley, who had a story that, I mean, I interrupted him a few times because he kept saying specific places like in Oregon and Nevada that I know very, very well. And this story is just mind-blowing. And the fact that he's like a true professional, I mean, he's written this book, but he's in the medical field, and his wife and him became obsessed with this story, just like Greg and I became obsessed with trying to solve Father Joe's murder of Deadly Diocese. And I just really resonated with him. And this is going to be a two or three parter. So, because it's a crazy story. So long before Burning Man, the same stretch of Nevada wasteland was home to something darker. A drifter named Ronald John Gress, known only by his nickname Bristol Wolf, which is the name of the book. But Nevada was his landing spot. He started out in so many parts of Oregon that I know to my core, and it freaked me out, and I was so fascinated by this story, and I think you guys are going to be unbelievably fascinated by it. So without further ado, here's Nathan Morley.
I just went straight off memory this time, typing it into the call recorder app. I'm impressed with myself. Nailed it.
Yeah.
But 775, that's how I know you're from, like, the Reno, Nevada area.
How long did you live in Reno for?
I never lived there. My grandparents lived there for a long time. So did my uncle. I just did stand-up there for a week at a time. I guess I did it three times. Just whatever. When you're on tour, there's so many shows, so many towns.
Yeah.
In Reno is when I dangerously thought it was funny to heckle some motorcycle gang dudes. I've not had a good history with motorcycle gang dudes. You don't fuck with them. I mean, they were fine. I mean, I charmed them. They were fine after I asked them how many people they'd killed. That was an aggressive thing to say on stage to people.
Yes.
There is like a famous murder in the Silver Legacy with motorcycles.
Yes, there is. The leader of the Hell's Angels was murdered there.
Yeah, well, yep, I learned that later.
Yeah, they don't think that's funny at all.
Oh, no, they don't, no. They're motorcycle gangs are the only people I've pissed off on my podcast.
I was trying to get a hold of you, not the leader of the Hell's Angels. I'm sorry about that.
I'm in the Mongols now. It's not a big deal.
They're
anyway,
sworn
I
enemies.
Got stories for days. But this is about you. So let's start the podcast.
Okay.
All right. Nathan Morley?
Yep.
Is that how I say it? Okay. All right. Well, welcome to the show, Nathan Morley.
Thank you.
Author of a cool book that's going to be turned into a movie.
Hopefully.
And who's basically on the run in Nevada. He's not, but Nevada's the Wild West, just like Colorado is. It is the Wild West.
Yeah, no question. Anywhere between Reno and Vegas, you're a man and you're going to have to take care of your own self. Ain't nobody going to come help you.
Do you feel that there? Like, do you feel that, like, because I feel that in Colorado. Like, so I'm from Oregon, then lived in L.A. for a long time. Now I live in the middle. I live in the absolute middle of nowhere, Colorado. But I do feel like it's the Wild West. Like anything could happen at any time.
Well, you live up in Oregon. I mean, there's parts of Oregon where you're like, what in the It's like you went into the movie, the wrong turn movie, you know?
Was that filmed there?
No, I think it was filmed East Coast, but I'm saying there's parts of Oregon that are definitely like that movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. I'm from a very small town in Oregon, so that makes a lot of sense to me. But this area in Colorado where I live now, I mean, I'll keep it brief because this is about you. I found a document from, and we're going to do a whole podcast about it, but it's a 1919 FBI document, 75 pages long, that lists all, because there was a big mafia thing that happened in this area, like bootlegging. And I'm pretty sure on our ranch that it's the goat ranch that they mentioned where they, like, literally killed a lot of people and buried them there. I have yet to find human bones, but not a lot of other bones, but mafia people tend to, like, to bury them underneath, like, cow bones. That's a tactic.
Kind of mix them up. Yeah, kind of mix them up a little bit.
Mix them up. Yeah. Love it. Anyway, but, okay. So you're kind of in the Wild West as well. So tell me more about yourself.
Well, I work in surgery in Reno for a private group, and that's kind of where this whole story began. I got this nightmare of a surgeon. Him and I were working together, and I simply said good morning to him, and he just, like, lost his mind on me. He cursed me out for, like, 5 minutes, calling me every name in the book, and then he came back around and, like, started putting all those bad words together and throwing them at me, you know, in different terms, in different ways, and told me never to talk to him again. And I just wanted to stick my thumbs through his eyes and bite his nose off. But I held my tongue and I worked the rest of the day with him. And all that stress, I had to just get it out, you know. So I just, like, drove out into the desert and went for a walk and just screamed at the Mother Nature and the earth. And I came upon this, like, ghost town. And I just wanted to know more about this ghost town because there was, like, a building and stuff everywhere. So I went back into Reno. That's where I'm from. And, I found a book on, like, old ghost towns, and I just started exploring the desert. And that's kind of what led me to find a lot of these crazy stories, and that's what led me to find Bristlewolf, yeah.
That's fascinating. I feel like we do connect, and I'm glad we have connected, because the ghost town stuff is, like, something that I've been very fascinated by since moving to Colorado. But there are many in Oregon, and my dad told me about some where he goes hunting there. But, like, I'm looking at right now, not joking, like, an old homestead that, like the Ludlow Massacre happened right here in Colorado, and it's fascinating. You walk around and you can see, I mean, it feels, like, very historic and very cool, and it's, I don't know, somehow healing to sort of absorb it and interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you're all alone and you're walking around a house that probably had 5-10 people walking around. There's probably been fist fights in the house and screaming and love and happiness and great moments of joy. And now it's just this broken skeleton that just has debris and animals that have ran through it. And you just kind of sit there and you go, huh, maybe my house will be like this one day. Maybe the future of my life will be like this when people will wonder, what was I doing back in the day, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. So that's what inspired you.
Well, so my wife and I, we got this book. I found this book at the bookstore. It was written by an author named Nell Merbarger. And she was a writer from the 1930s through the 50s. And she would go out by herself, a woman, all by herself with a pistol. And she would go to these old ghost towns. And back in those days, in the 30s and 40s, the pioneers, you know, from the 1800s, they were in their 70s and 80s. And so she would go out to these ghost towns that obviously dried up, and these people still live there. And she would interview them, take their pictures, and then write a little story about the ghost town from their words. And so, like, we would pick a chapter, my wife and I, and then we would just drive out to the ghost town that Nell Merbarger wrote about, and then we would read the chapter right there and then go explore and find stuff that Nell Merbarger talked about, you know? And it was just like, it was just like connecting to the past and having this great time in the desert. And it was like total stress relief from surgery and this jerk off of a surgeon, you know. Just so you know, he was an amazing surgeon. He was just a horrible human being.
Okay, I'm going to stop you. Are we allowed to talk about that guy? I mean, we haven't said his name, but I'm going to time code it in case.
Nope, we're fine.
We could.
I think as long as I don't say any names, no one will know nothing.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. No, but that's a passion of mine, like doing that type of thing. And doing that with your wife is so awesome. Greg and I have done that type of thing before. I've also scared the shit out of him. When he said, like, this is a woman in... Sorry, I make myself laugh. Doing that in New Mexico, one of the podcast episodes I did, there was a cult in New Mexico.
No, you got to be adventurous. That's what life's all about, right? You can't find anything if you're just sitting in your home all day.
Agreed. So you and your wife are adventurous. And so how'd you come across your, so you came across your Nevada story.
Yeah.
Just exploring.
Yeah. Like I would, I just fell in love with Nell Merbarger from like reading her books. And so I found myself running into people out in the desert and then I would sit and interview them. And I bought this little DJI mic and I would just stick it on them. And then we would like go walk around and talk for hours. And that would give us stuff to listen to on our way home. Cause you know, some of these ghost towns are 6-7 hours away. And we ended up buying a trailer so we could like camp out in the desert so we could spend more time out there to like explore and figure out stuff, you know? So
cool.
I came across this story about Josie Pearl, this amazing woman that lived out in the desert. And she was there when Bob Ford was killed in Creed, Colorado. Bob Ford is the guy that killed Jesse James.
Yep, I know exactly who it is. Yep.
So I wanted to find her house, and her house is up in the north end of the Black Rock Desert. Well, as I'm like going through Nell's book about this Josie Pearl, I find another author that went out there in the 1940s. His name was Ernie Pyle. Ernie Pyle was like the biggest star on the planet Earth back in the 40s because he wrote about the troops in World War II. He would sit there right next to them while they're fighting in the Pacific. And when he would come home from the war, he would go right out to Josie Pearl's cabin out in the Black Rock Desert. And so like now it was like this, holy shit, I can go out into the desert and sit with like one of the biggest names the planet has ever heard of, you know, back in the 40s, you know?
Cool.
And so it took us 3 years to find Josie Pearl's cabin. Right? 3 whole years, we'd drive up there, we'd go around, couldn't find anywhere, because there's no directions. Well, we ended up just like going down this random dirt road, and we just kept going, and it's exactly how Ernie Pyle described it in his book. It's like this little town, but then it's just a couple of cabins, but it feels like you're in a little area of people in town, you know? And so, and it's surrounded by poplar trees, and those poplar trees and the grass are still there. Her cabin is still intact. It's up against a mine that she built herself, and you can go inside the mine. Not now, the BLM.
She built a mine herself?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, she's a badass.
Wow.
I will send you the link so people can read her story. It's absolutely amazing.
That's so cool.
And you can go out to her cabin today, and you can sleep in it, and you can go into her mine. But the BLM blew it up a few years ago. The BLM is the Bureau of Land Management, not the Black Lives Matter movement. But so they blew up this mine, but you can still go into the mine, like, partially. And, she pulled out gold nuggets and everything else, and she talked about how she did all this stuff in the book. And we were blown away. Anyway, while we were there, this cowboy shows up on a horse, and he's sitting in the front yard. And, you know, there's no windows in this cabin. It's just that we're inside, and I look out the window. And there's the cowboy, and he's like, hey, I was just checking on you, making sure you guys are okay. And I was like, yeah, we're fine. Well, we just start talking, and he had surgery on his shoulder, and it just so happened to be that the guy that worked on his shoulder is the guy I work with. And so we made an instant connection. He invited my wife and I back to his ranch, and he saddled up some horses. We met his mom, and then like they rode us around the property. We ended up coming back to his home, and he was sitting around the dinner table, and they made us food and everything, you know, just hanging out. And we're just talking about whatever. And I already put a microphone on him. He's had a microphone on him for two hours. And I'm like, hey, is there anybody crazy? You know, that video that you and I are on, you know, the video that you shared on your Instagram.
Yeah. Instagram,
that video. Yeah.
Yeah.
That guy's voice. That's the actual first time I heard of the name Bristle Wolf. That's the actual interview, him telling me the story. And so
God,
he tells me, like,
this is so cool and so crazy.
Yeah.
It really does mirror a lot of the stuff that I've done. Again, not to make it about me, but it does mirror a lot of, I'm loving your energy.
Well, I've been telling this story for 9 years now, just so you know. So I asked him if he's known anybody crazy, and he just starts laughing. And him and his mom starts laughing, and he's like, well, there was this guy that lived out in the desert a few years ago. And he dug a hole out there. He's more animal than man. He was blown up. He blew himself up with some dynamite. He's all disfigured. His fingers and his face is all messed up and missing. And anyway, this young couple from Colorado with a treasure map shows up looking for their claim, and he kills them both. And then a few days later, another kook, when he says kook, he's talking about another hermit that lived out there back in the 1970s when this took place. Nevada was pretty prosperous in the idea of having desert hermits living out there. A lot of reporters from LA would actually come out into the Black Rock and like interview these hermits. Like, why would you live out here in the desert? You know, and I've got a few articles to share with your audience if they wanted to read those. But so
I wonder, sorry to interrupt you. I wonder if somebody came up with the concept with as the Hills Have Eyes. That was one of the scariest movies I ever saw.
Yeah, I'll tell you something about that too.
I had to leave the movie theater when I was in college and watched it. I was like, I got so scared. I was like, I don't like this at all. I think I started crying.
Yeah.
I can't really remember.
Yeah, I mean, if you had some like nuclear crazy hermits coming after you, I'd be terrified too. And when you're out in Nevada, out there, the hills really do have eyes. You never know who's watching you out there, you know?
Yeah.
So a few days after the couple was murdered, and he just leaves their bodies laying there about 50 feet from his hole, just rotting in the sun. Well, a few days later, his friend, a fellow hermit, comes out there to soak his feet in the hot springs, and he ends up killing him also, right? And that's all I had to go on.
He was just trying to have a spa day?
A desert spa day and you get shot. Yeah, talk about soul inspiring, right? So,
yeah, this is good.
Yeah.
This is good stuff. Keep going. Sorry.
Yeah, and that's all I had to go with. That's it. So I'm like, there's no way this story happened. And he says to me, are you calling me a liar in my own house? I said, well, I'm not calling you a liar, bro. But like, I mean, a story like that, a hermit that lives in the ground out in the Black Rock Desert, the most desolate area in all of America. He murders these three people and leaves their bodies to rot. And then he's arrested and he never talks to anybody. Like, I would think that would be a pretty big story. You know, I never even heard of it. And he's like, well, it's true. So I get back to Reno. The next day we drive back into Reno, because that's an 8-hour drive from where this all took place. And I look it up, and sure enough, it's a true story. And that's where I dug up the name Bristle Wolf. And I ended up taking these few newspaper articles that I found, and I just started writing down all the names that were in the newspaper article. And then I started contacting all these people, right? And then, like, over the years, I've been driving, flying, walking, freaking everything. I mean, I ended up sleeping in the killer's hole, going to the killer's hometown. Meeting his friends and family, met the friends and families of the victims. And I just started piecing all the story together. I met all the cops that arrested him, the judges. I met the governor of Nevada. He ended up letting me hang out in the prisons and stay in Bristle Wolf's prison cell. And, you know, and through it all, you find out that this guy, Bristle Wolf, was this actually a really great guy. He just had this horrible event happen in his life, which made him completely insane. And he ended up fleeing out into the desert and digging a hole in the ground and living off the land, eating roadkill and drinking from hot springs, and then just murdering people that got too close. Yeah, it's crazy.
Okay, I have a question, because I'm looking up what you kept saying, like Black Rock or whatever. I'm looking at where it is, and it says that's where, like, Burning Man is and stuff. Do you think he lost his mind because he did do, like, LSD or something, or?
No. So he ended up, so when he was, like, a young kid, he was, like, a normal kid. You know, he had friends, and they'd pile around and go camping and hunting and fishing, and they were just, like, these badasses. And, like, they were actually pretty, they were, like, the cool kids of the high school, him and his friends. And his friends ended up joining the Army in 1954, and he stayed behind because he wanted to be a farmer. They lived in a little town called Malin, Oregon. You probably don't even know where that's at, because not too many people know. But you,
Malin?
Yeah, M-A-L-I-N. Well, it's part of Klamath. You know Klamath Falls.
Yeah.
It's like a little suburb of Klamath.
I should know where this is, but this is where I'm from.
Well, don't feel. Yeah, don't feel surprised.
That's in the middle.
Yeah, I talked to a cop that worked his entire career in Oregon, and he never heard of Malin, and he worked all over the state.
Yeah,
and he was blown away when I showed him. Yeah.
Honestly don't even recognize the towns around it.
Yeah, nobody does. Only the people that live there, all 500 people that live in that area.
I bet they saw Sasquatch, though, there.
No, those aren't Sasquatch. They got the I can't remember what Indians those are. They have the Native Americans. Well, he ends up staying behind to be a farmer with his dad. And it just so happens to be like the worst farm season ever recorded, the worst farm season ever. And he loses all of his father's money, $22,000 that he dumped into this farm, and loses it all. And his dad's like, hey, it's no big deal. You're not an established farmer like I am, where I can take on bad seasons. You know, we'll hit it again next year. He says, nope. I'm going to go join the Army, and I'm going to pay you back. He says, son, the whole debt is forgiven. He says, no, I'm still going to join the Army, because that's the really good guy he was. So he ends up joining the Army, and he, like, excels in everything. And he went in as an enlisted man, and he gets promoted to officer training school, which is a huge honor. And he ends up going to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. It's an artillery school. And he was given his own crew, but he's going to train to be an officer. Well, while he's there, he's in his dorm room studying for his officer training test. And the people next door are making all this noise. And he, you know, bangs on the wall, says, hey, guys, can you keep it down? They kind of keep it down for a few, and then they start back up again. Well, this goes on and on and on. Well, eventually this phone call comes in to the military police. And the military police end up showing up, and there's Ronald Gress. This is who Bristlewolf is. He's standing in the hallway, screaming and freaking out, kicking on the door and losing his mind. And the military police are like, Cadet Gress, what's going on here? He says, well, these guys I've been asking to be quiet are just keep partying and getting loud, and I can't study. And I've asked them multiple times, and they just keep – and now they're laughing. And they say, well, Officer Gress, there's nobody in that room. That room's vacant. He says, well, open the damn door. I want to see for myself. But they open the door, and the room is completely empty. Well, he's later diagnosed with schizophrenia. And this is what would plague him for the rest of his career.
That would have been my guess.
Yeah.
That was my guess.
So, yeah. So this horrible disease destroys his brain, and he just kind of starts going downhill from there. Well, he ends up getting out, and he goes back home, and, you know, Klamath Falls is where the closest psychiatrist is at. So he has to drive to Klamath, which is only 20 minutes away, to get his medication and then come back to the farm. Well, you know just as much as I do, because you're a small town person, that when you're in a small town, if you fart in church, the entire community is going to know about it in a matter of hours, right? So everyone knows that he's a schizophrenic. He's a nut job. He's been kicked out of the army. Honorable
Well, that's sad. Poor guy.
Poor guy. Honorably discharged, by the way. And he's given $188 a month for the rest of his life. So he's living on the farm with his family.
Only $188? That's what he gets?
Well, this is 1956. This is pretty good money back in 56. I'm thinking it's probably like...
I don't know. But that seems...
Yeah. I mean, that's all the government gave him. No, it's not... But I think it's because he only served 2 years while he was there. So I'm thinking they probably would have given him more if he served more time or something. Maybe there was like a math equation that they came up with, like, well, you're here for 192 days, you get $192 or something. I don't know. You know, so... Yeah.
But it's unfair and not manageable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the military back in the 1950s. I mean, they were expecting you to get whacked on the battlefield. You know, this is back when World War II just finished and the Korean War is in full scale, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so anyway, he come. Yeah, what?
So
he ends up coming back home and his mom is like, oh, my gosh, you're home. And, you know, he's just kind of this broken figure because the drugs that they were giving you at the time were just making you kind of like you were just stoned after you, like, took, like, four bong rips off of a, you know, a six-foot bong. You know, so here he is drooling and just kind of walking around just half dead, you know. Well, eventually he starts, like, getting his life in kind of this, like, motion where he's, like, dealing with the drugs and he's trying to get along with, like, family. But you got to remember also this is back in the 1950s where, you know, if you're a farmer, you totally depend on your family to help you farm, you know. And he is a young, strong man, but, like, the father doesn't understand that his mental disease is a real thing. You know, back in those days, you see somebody that looks strong and young, you just assume that they can just easily put a fence post up and put some barbed wire on it, you know, or bale of hay, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, just do simple farm work. His father isn't, like, computing this, like, he's mentally disturbed. Like, things aren't clicking in the head. The computer is off.
Well, back in that day, it just, like, suck it up. Just suck it up. Like
Yeah, rub some dirt on it.
Rub some dirt on it. Like, pat you on the back.
Right.
Keep going.
Right. So, anyway, in 19... Oh, very sad. I mean, you know, when I first heard this story, I just thought, oh, this is cool. It's this psycho murderer that lived in a hole in the ground. And then as I began investigating it and getting more into it and meeting the friends and the families of him and of the victims and then all these other people that just kind of interacted as he went, and then you heard his whole story, you just start feeling horrible for him. And you just, like, you really – and that's kind of how I wrote the book. It's kind of like you just – you start off with this, like, crazy story, and then you'll eventually get to this point where it's like you're at a crossroads. Do you like Bristlewolf, or do you still hate him? Do you feel sorry for the victims, or do you really feel sorry for Bristlewolf? You know, and it's just kind of, it's a wild story. But he goes through all these horrible events where he tries to kill his sister in 1963 with a pistol, and she ends up running out of the house with her kid to her mom and dad's house. And he ends up going to jail, and then he ends up going to the Oregon State Hospital in Salem, Oregon, where he serves like 6 months there.
Okay.
Yeah, and then he's in Salem, Oregon, and then he serves 6 months there, and they let him go. And then he comes back home, and then in 1965, he pulls a shotgun on his father, and he tries to shoot his father in the house, which is this dramatic event that happens in the family home. I mean, you know, you're from a small town. Anybody that's listening that's from a small town, you understand that you're either probably a Christian or a Catholic, but you know, Sundays are kind of reserved for God, and you come home and you have Sunday lunch and everyone kind of gathers around the table and mom and sisters are putting food on the table. Well, this dramatic fight happens where his father's like, hey, Ron, I need you to help me out with some farm work tomorrow. He says, I'm not helping you. He says, well, I'm not asking. You're young and you live here under our roof. You're going to do what I ask you. He says, I ain't fucking helping you. And he stands up and this table full of food, plates, silverware, milk, iced tea, water, glasses. He just grabs the table and he throws it into the air. And all these items go flying all over the house. And he marches down the hallway And he goes into his room and he grabs his shotgun. Well, his father is recovering from hip surgery. So he gets up, you know, sparingly and starts hobbling down the hallway. And Ron comes up the hallway holding the shotgun. And his dad grabs a hold of that shotgun and they're fighting over the shotgun. And he's almost killed by him. Well, anyway, they're wrestling and the mom gets involved and they tackle him and they kind of wear him out and finally get the gun from him and they call the sheriff and he's arrested again. And he's taken back to the Oregon State Hospital. And this time he's there for almost a year. And they let him go again for the attempted murder of his stepfather. So now he's got two attempted murders. And this time he comes home and he realizes that his family's against him. And so he's kind of like, I'm out of here.
Well, maybe he's tried to kill them a couple times.
Yeah. Well, because they're making him mad, but his mind is playing tricks on him.
But it is sad. Like, but people didn't recognize mental illness at that point. Like,
they did not.
May I argue this? How do you even actually handle that type of situation? I mean, okay, so he goes to a hospital. They're not healing him. He probably got that from, and that was also the time when you were first starting to tell this, that was around the time when Charles Manson, they say, was like dosed with LSD or whatever it was. Like it was like CIA some shit. I don't quite know, but.
No, you're right. You're right on the money. I think you're right.
Yeah, like
yeah.
His brain could have been messed up because you said he came back drooling. I don't know. Like when I got in my car accident, for example, again, not to make it about me, but I love to. It's really my passion. but I was so freaked out when I was in good spirits. I did army crawl out of the truck and then like army crawl on the ground until they came and got me because I didn't know that airbag smoked. I thought the truck was going to blow up. I was like, oh shit, it's going to blow up.
Holy shit.
No, it wasn't going to blow up. I guess the airbag smoked, but I thought that's what was going to happen because I was going to take a nap.
Yeah.
And then I was like, all right, get yourself out of the truck. And then I swan dived out, and then army crawled.
No wonder you had a spinal cord injury. You swan dived out of the truck.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, you're not supposed to move. I knew I broke my back right away. I knew right away that we had a water tank in the back, and I knew that's what hit. I knew where it hit.
So you're like, you know what? I got a kink in my back. I'm going to go ahead and swan dive out and make sure it's completely popped. Let's do this.
Yeah, exactly. But then it was also so cheap that when the OnStar, because it was a 2023 truck, brand new truck. Or 2023.
This is OnStar. Do you need help? Do you need help? No. Are you going to charge me for this call? Yes, ma'am. No, I don't need help. Leave me alone. Leave me alone.
They said they're sitting in the ambulance. I was like, I can't afford that. No. I was like, someone can drive me.
Can you call my Uncle Bob? He's a mile from here. Don't call an ambulance.
Well, no, my father-in-law and husband were a mile from where I was at. I called them. I was like, come pick me up.
I just swan dived on the concrete.
I would have let them because I probably would have been paralyzed because I was on paralyzation watch for like 6 months.
Oh my gosh.
My toes still go numb at night. Doesn't matter. Not about
it. It is called the Rachel O'Brien Show.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's always the Rachel O'Brien Show. But point being, like, giving someone, like, drugs when, like, it scared the shit out of me when they took me to the hospital and they were like, oh, put her on fentanyl, and I started screaming. I was like, no. And they're like, it's not street fentanyl. And if you do OD, like, we'll, you know, resuscitate you. I was like, I don't want it though.
We could resuscitate you. We could just zap you and then shoot this crazy dart of drugs into your heart and bring you back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What is that movie? With John, whatever his name is.
Yes. Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction. Yeah, exactly. But
yes.
You dose people with stuff, and it's scary for them. Like that, his brain might not have been that messed up had they not probably given him some sort of, I don't know, either.
Yeah. Well, the drug.
Or.
Yeah, the drug that he was on was Prolixin. So Prolixin is this mummifying drug that when you take it, you just become numb to the world. You just kind of fall off.
Did you just say mummifying?
Off. Yeah, you're just kind of this mummy. You're just like, brr.
That's,
you know?
Terrifying.
Terrifying. And then, but see, what it does is it quiets the voices in your head. Now, check this out. I interviewed Gristlewolf's psychiatrist. Him and I became really good friends. He's a psychologist, I should say. You know, and him and I became really good friends. His name is Don Moldy, and he passed away about 2 months ago, unfortunately. He had cancer, and it's just him and I would go out into the desert together and explore. And, like, him and I became really good friends, and we started, like, interviewing serial killers in Nevada prisons all over the state. And we would go out to their murder sites and, like, do little shows together, which we never posted because we just kind of were just having fun hanging out together. Well, anyway, he ended up passing away.
Wait, I want to hear these interviews. Wait, this is cool.
yeah, I'll start posting them once I'm done with Bristlewolf. I got to get the Bristlewolf story out, you know. But, yeah, so Don Moldy, yeah, he's a really cool guy. And, you know, he got to interview Bristlewolf or Ron Gress the second time, and he knew he was clearly disturbed because he was just kind of like, he thought his family was against him. He thought everybody in the town was against him. He thought everybody in the town was trying to get him married, and he didn't want to get married. I said, well, Don, why is a schizophrenic like this? He says, well, listen to this. Just imagine you're driving down the road from work, or you're going to work, or whatever. It doesn't matter. You're in the car by yourself, and all of a sudden, a voice just comes out and says, Rachel, what are you doing? You would shit yourself. Right? I mean, someone's
that
talking.
That never happened.
Right. Well, somebody's just talking to him. And so here you have this voice, and some of them have visions or see things that aren't there, you know, and like all these crazy events. And he says the Prolixin just deadens all of this. But it also at the same time takes away all your energy, takes away all your like brain functions. And so you start losing like time. You start losing like the days start blurring in together, you know? And so you would just sit there for hours on end, if not days, just kind of drooling into your own brain, just wondering what the hell is even happening around you, you know? So this is a horrible, you know, it's like the, what is the greater worse, schizophrenia full on or drugs that slow the voice, but you're just kind of this.
But was he made that way because of his military time and they, like.
Well, this is just the medication they gave him to deaden the schizophrenia. Because when he was on full blown schizophrenia, he was just crazy, running around town, screaming at people or talking to people that aren't there. You know, just kind of this crazy.
But did he get that from his military experience?
Well, so that part of the military experience is like back, I think that's back east, like far east, and he was south. So I don't think he was any part of that testing. I think he just had schizophrenia. All of his age, like his age group for men between the ages of 18 and 25 is pretty much lines up perfectly for like when people get schizophrenia at that age for men.
Women
usually get schizophrenia between 28 and 35. Which is unfortunate because basically for
the same age range.
Well, it can be, but I'm talking majoritively speaking. So the majority of women that get schizophrenia are between 28 and 35. For men, it's 18 to 25. But you can get schizophrenia between any age, but just majoritively speaking, you know. And I guess you can challenge me on that, too.
You and I are both over the age, I'm guessing. I don't know.
Yeah, we're free.
Yeah,
I'm 49.
I'm 40. I'm free. I'm out.
You're out. So he ends up getting released again, this time for the murder of his stepfather. He gets released. And his whole family shows up, and they're, like, pleading, like, hey, you can't let him out. He tried to kill me in 63. He tried to kill my father a year ago. You can't let him go. And he's sitting there listening to them, pleading for them to keep him at the hospital. Well, he takes this as a big betrayal, and he ends up getting out of the hospital anyways, and he flees to Seattle, Washington. and he works for a company called Boeing. I'm sure you've heard of Boeing Industries.
Yeah, Boeing.
And he's a data entry person, and he's just sitting there. And so this is the day-to-day work. You show up, you walk over, and you grab a stack of paperwork that you need to put into the computer. Because this is 1967. In 1967, computers are on the rise, right? You got this like punch computer, and then like the real computers don't show up until like the 80s, you know, and then the 90s and whatever. But this is like the first computer. So they're putting this paperwork into this punch computer. And all you do is you put the, and you just start typing out what everything, and it goes into this computer onto these little cards. And so then you can feed this card into it, and then it'll tell you the data that you typed into it. Well, so you grab a stack, you put it down, you type it in, and then you give the stack to a person that drives by with this cart, and then you go over and you grab another stack, and you do 3 to 4 stacks a day. That's the typical work. Well, Ron is sitting there, and he's watching everybody else work, and he realizes, like, oh, okay, so about every 2 hours, everyone grabs a stack and then gives it to the lady. So he kind of figures out, like, how people are doing it, and he doesn't even work for, like, 3 months. He just, like, moves a stack here and then puts it on the cart and doesn't do any work. Well, he gets reported because people see him not working like everybody else. Well, he has this giant explosion at work, and they end up firing him. And at this point, he just loses his mind, and he flees into the North Oregon, which is called Granite, Oregon. Have you ever heard of Granite, Oregon, the Blue Hills, the Blue Mountains?
I think so, yeah. I think so.
Granite, so that's where the hills have a... Yeah, yeah. Look up Baker City, Oregon. That's where it's at. It's close to Baker City.
No, Baker City's awesome.
Yeah.
No, Baker City has one of the best hotels. I ended up
staying at that hotel while I was doing my investigation. And here's one of the great stories.
Nice rooms?
Oh yeah, it's a great place. If you're listening to this podcast, you should definitely go to Baker City, Oregon, and you know which hotel it'll be. I don't know what the name of it is, but it's an old hotel.
It's absolutely amazing.
Oh, it's great.
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely gorgeous. The room we stayed in was huge.
And they have great coffee. Great coffee.
Yeah,
too.
It is Geyser Grand. Yeah, Baker City, Oregon. I'm looking it up. Yeah, my parents don't live too far from there now. And my dad hunts around there. So, like, yeah,
nice.
I know that area well.
Well, then your dad hunts exactly where I'm going to tell you that this is at. This is called Granite, Oregon. Granite, Oregon is an old ghost town. Granite, because you probably don't know about it because it's kind of like a hidden gem of Oregon. And a lot of hunters know about it. It's an old ghost town, yeah. But
my dad knows about ghost towns, and he tells me about them often. It probably is that place. Oh, now I want to call him.
Oh, yeah.
Shit.
Yeah, yeah, you got to call him after this. Because Granite is a very unique ghost town where the miners back in the 1800s, when the town dried up and died, this doctor came in. His name was Doc Brown. And Doc Brown came in, and he cleaned up all the cabins that were there. And there was only, like, I want to guess there's probably like 12 cabins, 15 cabins that were there. Anyways, Doc Brown, you know, very wealthy guy in Baker City, Oregon, he had a cabin of his own up in Granite, and he would clean off these cabins. And then in the summertime, when you would come up and camp, you could camp inside these cabins completely for free. All you had to do was make sure that you cleaned up after yourself when you left, and that was it, right? And he ran this little grocery store that's still there today. And now Granite is not really a ghost town. There's people that live there, but your father will know about it. Well, back in 1968.
Well, what's the guy's name that runs it? Because my dad had told me this story fairly recently to me and Greg about some guy that lives on the mountain that, I don't know, owns something, and it's a ghost town, and it's a place they hunt, and he explained kind of similar to what you're saying.
Oh, it might be the same guy, but Doc Brown died a long time ago. He died in, like, the
80s. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, this is, I'm talking about 1968, so I don't know who runs it now.
Okay.
But I went up there a few years ago, or just last year, actually, and there's lots of houses there. People live there now. And there's an old graveyard. They got graves from the 1840s, I think, up there. I mean, it's really crazy. It's a really cool town, you know, just to go up, and it's very beautiful. It's up in the Blue Mountains.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
In the winter of 1968, a phone call comes into Baker City, Oregon, from Doc Brown. He says, hey, there's a guy up here lighting fires inside the cabins. Now, listen, I'm not too worried about him. I'm just worried that he's going to burn down one of these old cabins. They say, oh, no, worry about Doc Brown. We'll send somebody up there. We'll have Officer William Barry come up there and check it out. Now, Officer William Barry is a very unique individual. He's an amazing man, and I had the pleasure of interviewing him at his home with his wife. They made us dinner, and we got to sit around and talk about Bristlewolf and his experience with this. And this story is absolutely amazing. Now, in 1968, Doc Brown calls down to Baker City, Oregon, and William Barry takes the call, and he drives on up to Granite, Oregon. And when he's up there, in his police report, which I have, he says, I went up to Granite, Oregon. I did my first survey. I didn't find the person that Doc Brown was talking about, but I had the very unusual feeling that I was being watched. I will return tomorrow. So the next day he shows up, and now the drive from Baker City to Granite, I believe, is only like 34 miles. But regardless of when you drive it, it's going to take you about an hour and a half to get up there because it's such a windy road. And we went up there the exact same day that this event happened. And there's probably about 6 feet of snow up there in the mountains. And this is what happens. So William Barry drives his patrol car up there. And now, back in 1968, a patrol car just had the police insignia spray painted on the side of the car, and that's it. Besides that, it was just a regular car. And he had a shortwave radio. There was no, like, police bars or, you know, where he could just get on the radio and talk to anybody from miles around. He had to be within 20 to 30 miles of somebody to get a hold of anybody. But he's up in the mountains, and so now he's all by himself. There's nobody that he can call to, and he drives his car up there. He parks because he sees smoke coming out of this place called the courthouse, which is actually a schoolhouse. Well, anyways, Officer Barry gets out of the car, and he walks up to 4 feet of snow, and he walks around the entire structure, which is a very small structure, the one-room schoolhouse. It's probably about 15 feet long and about 12 feet wide. That's it. And it's just one room. And I'll send you a picture if you wanted to post that on your podcast.
Yeah, I will.
And as he's walking around it, he's heading back to his car, a big gust of wind hits the front of the building, and it moves the front panel that covers the window. All the windows have been boarded up. So this big gust of wind hits this front panel, and it starts sliding side to side. Well, Officer Barry walks over there, and he pushes it over. And inside, he sees Ronald Gress sitting there at a table with a shotgun between his legs, staring down at a little fire that he's got inside this little tin box. And it's full of smoke, so it's dark and it's smoky. And Officer Barry says, hey, you mind if I come and talk with you? And Gress says, I don't care, come on in. Now, this is a very peculiar way to get into the room. He has to, with his left hand, push the panel off to the left and then step in with his right leg and then bend over to kind of like swoop under and then bring his left leg in and then let go of the panel to get inside the house. And once that panel slides closed, it's completely dark, full of smoke. And he's sitting there talking with Bristlewolf, but at this time, he's not Bristlewolf yet. I want to make sure that's very clear. He doesn't become Bristlewolf yet. And I'll explain that in a minute.
He changes his name? Okay.
His whole identity. He changes everything here pretty soon. So
okay.
Right now, his name is Ronald Gress, and that's his real name.
Okay.
And now Ron is sitting in the middle of the schoolhouse. So he's about 6 feet inside the house. And Officer Barry tells me that his butt is up against the window. So he's not, like, doing anything. He's just kind of standing there talking to him. And as his eyes are kind of, like, adjusting to the darkness and the smokiness, and they're just talking about whatever, he realizes that there's a dead duck in the corner of the room. Now, back in 1968, an officer of the law was not just a cop that, like, would pull you over for speeding, but they had multiple hats. He was also the wildlife fishing game, you know, and other, but at this point, he's using his wildlife fishing game brain, and he says, hey, that's a dead duck, and it's not duck season. And Ron Gress looks at him and says, well, I'm a general in the Army, and I went ahead and opened duck season. And Officer Barry tells me, he says, right when he says that, Nate, I realize that he's not playing with a full deck. And I've had to deal with these kind of people before, you know. And I says, well, you know, that's fine and dandy, but you can't just open up duck season because there's state law. And he says, well, officer, federal law supersedes state law. And he says, this is where it got interesting. And it was because I said this to him. He says, I said, well, you're wrong. And as soon as I said you were wrong, he jumped up and pulled that shotgun on me, and he put it in my face.
Oh, my God. He's
got a 12-gauge shotgun, and all I have is a 38 special. And I don't want to pull my gun out because I don't want to, you know, make this bigger than what it needs to be because this is over a stupid duck. And he's got his shotgun in my face, but I grabbed the barrel with my left hand, and my right hand has got my, hand on my pistol. And he's reaching for my pistol. And he says, we're kind of tugging around just for, you know, maybe 6 or 7 seconds. When he finally understands that he's not going to get a hold of my pistol, he puts both hands on his shotgun and he falls back into like a shooting position. So now he's kind of on the floor, you know, kind of sitting on his butt, and he pulls the trigger. And this is where Officer Barry gets really crazy about this part. He says, all of a sudden, everything slows down. And I'm just watching all this happen in slow motion. And he pulls the trigger, and I see the shotgun explode, and I see the wadding coming out of the shotgun, slowly coming across the room at me. And I'm thinking, I can just move out of the way. But I'm stuck in this slow motion, and it hits me in the chest. And all of a sudden, everything's back to normal speed, and I can see in his eyes that he's amazed that I'm still standing. I'm amazed that I'm still standing, and I pull my pistol, and he racks another shell into that shotgun, and we're both inside this cabin, in this dark cabin, all alone in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of this ghost town. I'm more than 60 miles away from the nearest person to help me, and this guy's screaming at me to surrender my weapon, and we're going back and forth about surrendering my weapon. I'm not going to give me your gun. I'm not giving you my gun, back and forth. And eventually, Officer Barry says, I got to calm this guy down. He says, listen, I'm going to leave. And nobody needs to get hurt over a stupid duck. And Ron Gress kind of says, no, you can't do that. And he says, I'm leaving. And then eventually, Ron Gress says, okay, you can leave. But now Officer Barry's got a predicament. Because now he's got to turn his back on Ron Gress to get out of this cabin. You know, to get out, to push that board off to the side. So he says, don't you shoot me. He says, I won't shoot you. So he turns around and he opens the window and he gets out. And as he's going through 4 feet of snow to get back to the squad car, Bristlewolf, Ron Gress, opens up that window and he says, I was just testing you. He says, Nate, when he told me that, that stuck with me for 10 years. 10 whole years I've always thought about why he said that to me.
I have one quick question.
When you were
explaining that, and maybe it's that I don't understand like guns that well, I thought it sounded like he shot him. Like you said, something came out of the.
Yes. Okay. So I'm glad you asked me that. I said that just so you could ask me a question. So in a shotgun, when a shell is exploded, behind all the BBs is a thing called the wadding, and what this is a big plastic plunger, and what it does is it goes with the BBs, and what it does is it kind of cleans the barrel as it shoots out of the barrel, and it ensures that all the BBs kind of stay into one pocket, and then once it gets to the end of the barrel, the wadding opens up like a hand, and then it kind of like throws the BBs out, right? Well,
but do you visually see it normally? Because I've shot a shotgun many times before.
Correct. Now, that's where this is where the craziness of our brains come in, and I talked to the psychologist about this, and he says, well, sometimes because we're in this moment of insane stress, our eyes can capture things that normally wouldn't capture, and we can smell things that we can't normally smell, and we can feel things that we wouldn't normally feel. And so Officer Barry seeing the wadding coming out is a very real thing. He must have saw it because it was just like this. He was in like a slow motion punch, right?
Oh,
so as the wadding, yeah. So as the wadding came out, he didn't understand why he wasn't killed from this. But it was later revealed that Ron Gress was self-loading his own shotgun shells. And so when he swung that barrel up, they believe that all the BBs fell out of the wadding because he didn't crimp it well enough. So when he swung it up, all the BBs already slid out of the barrel. And then when he shot him, he just got hit with the wadding. Now, interesting fact here. I have this recorded. I had my friend, and we filled out all this paperwork, and I even told it on the internet, and I had it videotaped and everything, and I had him shoot me with a 12-gauge shotgun at 5 feet with a shell with no BBs in it, just the wadding. And it still hurts.
This is risky. What are you talking about? What?
Yeah, yeah. I had to know. I had to know if Officer Barry felt.
It didn't have. Okay.
Because Officer Barry's still
alive. I
don't
understand how the gun works. Then, because if I ask someone to shoot me, I'd have to be absolutely insane.
Yeah, I'm not all there, Rachel. I'm kind of a goofball. I want to bring you back to the point that when I was doing this, investigating this whole story, this was all because of stress from work. I had no intentions to writing a book or looking for a movie deal. I was just like living this story, just living the story. That's all I was doing.
Understand that. I understand becoming obsessed with something. I've become obsessed with several different cases that I've covered for my podcast. And
yeah,
we did a ballistics test for Deadly Diocese, but I wasn't having the gun shot at me. That's taking it to a new level there. But
I had to know.
You have something shot at you. You never know.
Yeah. Yeah,
you
yeah.
I don't know, but yeah, Greg made ballistics, some jelly thing. It's pretty fascinating. You should look at it on Instagram. It really does, in my opinion, prove for sure that Father Joe Moreno did not.
Well, just so you know, there's a huge difference between a shotgun shell and a bullet from a pistol. A huge difference. So a bullet.
Well, I do know that. Yeah.
A
shotgun shell, it sprinkles out. Right.
Yeah, it sprinkles out. But if there's nothing to sprinkle out, then all you're going to get hit with is just gunpowder and a big piece of plastic called the wadding. And that wadding still hurts like a son of a bitch, just so you know. It's not easy.
Well,
I mean, it knocked me right off my feet.
I can't believe you chose to shoot yourself like that.
I have it all videotaped as well.
I want to see it, actually, even though I like you enough to enjoy that. I would prefer that you don't hurt yourself, but
well, it's already too late.
I get being adventurous.
Yeah, well, check this out. With the shotgun, my friend was about 5.5 feet. We measured it exactly where Barry and Gress were standing, and he shot me at 5 feet, and that's from the tip of the shotgun. The tip of the shotgun was 5.5 feet from me.
5 feet. Okay. All right.
5.5 feet. So 5 feet and 6 inches. And when he shot me, my white T-shirt, I wore a white T-shirt to capture everything.
You're also out of your fucking mind that you did this. I can't even believe it. But.
So the white T-shirt, and it was probably like a 6-inch wide circle of all gunpowder. And then the wadding, because it hit so hard, it puffed out when you hit a blanket full of dust, you know how like all the dust, the wadding hit so hard that it knocked all the gunpowder off of that. So it's like this cross in the middle of my chest. And I had this giant swell in the middle of my chest for like a month. And it knocked me off my feet. And I laid there for a minute.
Oh,
and my friend walked in and he says, are you dead? I said, no, I'm still here, but that hurt like a soul.
I need
all
to
had a good
phone
laugh.
Number. I need to give her a call. I would die being
Rachel. She was holding the camera.
Oh my god, I would lose my fucking mind.
Oh yeah, we talked about this for a long time.
I'm gonna give her a call.
yes. So Officer Barry lives and he drives down the highway and he gets a hold of the police. His partners, and they come up and they eventually arrest Bristlewolf Ron Gress. And when they get him in the car, they only have handcuffs. That's it. And there's no reason to put him in the back seat. They put him in the front seat. So he's sitting in between Officer Barry, who's driving, and another officer that's in the passenger seat. And he's sitting in the front seat with in between both these guys. And he stares at Barry. I mean, you know how tight you can get into the front seat of a car. And he's just staring at Barry the whole time for the 1 hour drive back to Baker City. And he says, "I'm going to get you, Barry." And he just keeps repeating that over and over and over again. Well, he never goes to court. He never goes anywhere. He ends up back to the Oregon State Hospital, where he's there for 6 or 8 months. And then he's released again for his third attempted murder. Isn't that crazy?
That is insane.
Yeah.
I'm writing down the names, though. Like, it's just fascinating to me.
Yeah.
How is this not more well known?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I got that all down for you, too.
I do wonder if my dad knows about it, because he knows about that area. I mean, I know about that area. That's technically sort of where I'm from, but I commend you for finding this story, because I've never heard this story before.
Yeah, it's crazy. And this is just a little bit of it. This is just the beginning. Well, in 1969, he's released from the Oregon State Hospital on what is called like a family restriction. He's supposed to stay in Malin and work, and then every 6 months he needs to come back to the Oregon State Hospital for a follow-up. Well, he just flees. He just takes off, and they can't find him anywhere. His mom is looking frantically. I want to make sure this is a really big point. His family loves him very much. They're very confused how this amazing young man, who was a star athlete in high school, who excelled in the military to the point where he was invited to officer training school. You know, here is this like amazing athlete. We never really went over that whole part, because I don't want to give up too much information. I really want people to buy the book. But
an amazing. Everyone, buy the book. Buy the book. I'm fascinated by this. Please buy the book.
The book is called Bristle Wolf, and it's not out yet. Just so you know, Rachel. Bristle Wolf. Yep. BRISTLEWOLF. And you can go onto my Instagram or my Facebook from Rachel's Instagram, and you can look up. We collaborated on a video together, which I thank you so much for doing. Your audience is amazing.
No problem. Thank you for doing this talk. I'm fascinated by this. Like, I'm buying the book, and I'm like, I literally can't wait to call my dad and be like, "You must know about this." Unless, of course, it's that unknown.
It's pretty unknown. I mean, I know people that have lived in Nevada for 40, 50 years, and they never heard about it. And it's a pretty amazing case. So,
yeah, but this is Oregon.
Anyway.
You're doing a lot of Oregon stuff. So.
Yeah. Matter of fact, check this out. Just so you know, while I'm interviewing Officer Barry about this in his home, his wife comes out and says, "You never told me about this." He says, "Dear, I just didn't want to worry you." That was the first time she ever heard about it. 40 something years after the fact. Isn't that crazy? And I have that all on video.
Crazy.
Yeah.
But that's how you know something is actually true, is when people don't want to speak about it. You don't want to speak about the unspeakable, essentially. Like, it's.
Yeah.
That's how I believe things are more true.
Oh, yeah. Well, just so you know, it wasn't like I just called up Officer Barry and was like, "Hey, I'm going to come interview you about this event." No. This was like a 3 week back and forth, and he was telling me to get lost. And I was like, "Brother, you're a fucking hero. Do you realize you're a hero? You stood in the middle of nowhere in a burnt out cabin with a psychopath that shot you. And most people would have ran and went home and said, screw that. You came back and you arrested him personally. Like, that's amazing. You're a stud, bro. You're a stud."
Yeah,
eventually,
it's insane.
Yeah. And eventually he called me up one afternoon. Actually, I was at work, and he said, "I'll do the interview, but you have to be here tomorrow." So my wife and I jumped in our car, and we drove 16 hours all the way to his house from Reno all the way to Baker City, Oregon, or 12 hours or whatever it is. So Ron Gress gets out of Salem again, the Oregon State Hospital. And this time he understands the system fully because he's been there two times and the system hasn't changed. You come in, you sign here, they get you on the regimen of drugs and counseling, blah, blah, blah. You say the right things and then you get to get upgraded to this level, this level, this level. He does the whole song and dance and he gets out early. And this time he fools them because they say, well, you have to, we're going to let you go home, but you have to come back every 6 months. Well, this time he just takes off and now they can't find him. And just like I said before, his family loves him very much and they're looking frantically for them, for him. Well, in 1970, March of 1970, don't quote me on this. I might be wrong. I don't have my notes in front of me. So sometime in 1970, in the winter of 1970, all over the entire country, a giant newspaper article goes out. Hermit blows himself up in dynamite accident, walks 12 miles and survives. Right? What? So a phone call comes in to Mama, what? Mama Gress. What? Yeah. Yes, yes.
How is this not more well known? What?
It gets even crazier after this story as well. Now, phone call comes in to Mama Gress, and she says, hello. And the guy says, hey, your son is Ron Gress? She says, yeah. He says, listen, he just blew himself up with dynamite in the middle of the night up in Nevada, and he walked 12 miles through a storm. He's in the hospital in Reno, and he's got frostbite. He's missing fingers. He's got major injuries, and he might not make it through the night. So I just want to let you know. So the whole family drives to Reno, and they see him in the hospital, and his left arm is broken with his shoulder, and his main artery that runs through your left arm is severed. And he's also missing his thumb on his left hand. On his right hand, he's missing his pinky, ring finger, and middle finger. And his arm is broken, with a bone is sticking out of his face is completely annihilated. A giant rock smashes him in his face, and he leaves him blind. And they believe, because of the blood amount that was on the ground, that he was laying there for almost 20 minutes unconscious. He gets up in the middle of the night, has no idea where he's at. He's covered in blood and rock and dust and gunpowder from the dynamite stick that went off. And he walks 12 miles through the Nevada desert where he finds a light, a ranch, and he goes in and knocks on the door. And the cook of the ranch house opens it and passes out from what he sees, this god-awful, horrible human being that is just has no clothes from the waist up, is completely covered in black soot and blood and crusty and blue, just destroyed. Well, the cook passes out, makes such a scene that all the other ranchers jump up and they run up and they see Ron Gress standing there all destroyed. And they put blankets on him, they throw him in the pickup truck, and they drive him 120 miles to the nearest town, which is called Winnemucca, Nevada. And they end up taking him to Reno.
Oh my God, just shut up. No, literally, yeah. Shut up. No, hold on. Sorry. I was holding my ears because I didn't want to hear totally about like the gross. I have to call. My parents are driving through. I was trying to find them a hotel. Oh my God, they're going to Winnemucca, Nevada. My parents live in Eastern Oregon. You mentioned so many fucking things that is freaking me out. And I was on the phone with them earlier. And they were like, well, we're like 80 miles or something from Winnemucca. My dad's driving them, and they're hauling. I can't believe you just fucking said Winnemucca. Like, I hate you. I officially hate you.
So they get him to Winnemucca. They get him to Winnemucca. They end up getting him to the hospital in Reno, which is for the military. So they get in there and the family's there and they talk to him and they say, what were you doing up there? He says, well, I was trying to mine and I stole some dynamite from a guy. And, I went up into the desert and I stuck the dynamite stick into the crack and I crimped it. And then because the dynamite didn't look like it was stuck in there all the way, I went ahead and punched it with my right hand, and when I punched it, it blew up. And you know, so here he is. And if you look at that, if you look at my Instagram, there's that picture of him. You know, that video that I sent you. There should be a video. It says before and after. That picture before is him in high school, and then the picture after is what he looked like on the day he was arrested for the murders out in the Black Rock. So,
I agree. I love it. I've enjoyed this story to the point that I definitely want to have like at least two more conversations, because this has been fascinating.
Oh, there's a lot more.
Taking notes while you were talking. I want to understand more.
Yeah, it does.
You're gonna get a movie made about this.
Hey, you know, if this is something that you're really into, true crime and stuff, I've got a lot of stories, dude. Like, I have a story that's gonna be. Anyway, I'm talking to the guy in prison right now, and he's definitely a serial killer. He's killed 4 people, and he's been let go out of prison. He gets out and he kills 2 more people. He ends up killing his own brother. He cut his head off, threw him down a mine shaft. Him and I are talking right now, currently, but he might be responsible for over 100 murders.